So, you've made it to the end. So, just start from the beginning. If you got the bookmarks, Divrei Hayamim is easy. Divrei Hayamim is the longest chronological book in Tanakh for one very simple reason. It starts at the beginning and it goes to the end. This whole thing over here, orange, dark orange, red, light green, dark green, blue, whatever, all of that, everything. Divrei Hayamim tells it all. It starts off with Adam. Starts off with Adam. And it goes to the rebuilding, of the Beit HaMikdash. So all of Jewish history in Tanakh is in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles. There is one fundamental question that everybody asks on Divrei Hayamim. And I can't give you a summary of Divrei Hayamim. Like I said, it's everything. Anything you heard today, pretty much, is there in some form or another. It is deja vu, but not quite. The problem with Divrei Hayamim is it retells the stories of Tanakh, and yet it changes them. It tells the stories, and facts are changed, and details are added, and details are left out, and you hear the same stories, and each time you sit there, and you just scratch your head, and you say, I think I heard this story at some point, 6, 10, 12 hours ago in a shir, and it doesn't quite sound the same. So the fundamental question everyone wants to know is, there's more sources in the back, is what is this book that we call Divrei Hayamim? So I took a course in YU, Divrei Hayamim, with Professor Sean Zelig Astor. So did Adam Friedman. And he answered simply, and this is the answer that is in general given. Divrei Hayamim is not a historical work. It is a historiographical work. Now, what is historiography? Historiography is where we don't study history. We study the study of history. Right? We re-examine history. And he started with this article I gave you, number one, from Edward Halakar. History is a continuous process of interaction between the historian and his facts, an unending dialogue between the present and the past. The facts speak only when the historian calls on them. The fundamental insight of historiography is that there is no such thing as history. History is only the spin you put on it. Now that sounds cynical, but it really isn't. Let me give you the following example. If you're writing a history book of the prime ministers of Canada in the 21st century, what do you include in that book? Most of you would not include what Justin Trudeau chooses to have for breakfast on the average morning, nor what Stephen Harper had for breakfast. If, on the other hand, you're a historian of food, then that's very relevant information. What counts as important historical facts depends on the story you're trying to tell. If you're trying to tell the story of history, then breakfast is important and politics is not. If you're telling the history of Canadian politics, then international relations is important and breakfast food is not. But which of those stories you choose to tell, there is no objective right answer. Which of these are more important? It depends. What are you interested in? That's Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim retells history. But it leaves certain facts out that we know from the rest of Tanakh because they were important for the story that was being told in that book, and they're not important for the story that Divrei Hayamim wants to tell. And it includes details that aren't in Tanakh, not because they didn't happen, but because the author of Divrei Hayamim, we'll see who that is in just a minute, in addition to the books of Tanakh in front of him, has other histories. You read through Sefer Malachim, at the end of every story it says, this is the history of Shlomo, and the rest of Shlomo's history is in Divrei Hayamim, in the Chronicles of Shlomo, meaning there were other history books available. They weren't important for the work of Malachim, but you know what? They were for Divrei Hayamim. So who is this author? And what's the story he's trying to tell? So the Gemara number 2 tells you, Yirmiyahu katav sifro sefer melachim. Yirmiyahu wrote melachim. Ezra katav sifro v'yachas shel divrei hayamim adlo. But Ezra wrote divrei hayamim, meaning divrei hayamim may focus primarily, tells all of history, but it focuses on the period of the kings. But it's not written by Yirmiyahu. It's not written in the time of the destruction of the third Beis HaMikdash. It's written, as Reiter Tiner talked about, in the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, what's important to his history is so different. So Ezra writes the chronology up to him, Uman Aske, and then who finishes it? Nehemiah ben Chachalia. So Nehemiah finishes the book. Rabbi Chaim Angel puts it, the historiographical issue, this way. The Gemara in Megillah number 3 tells you, Harbei Nevi'im Amdulahem Yisrael, Kiflaim Kiloseh Mitzrayim. There were many prophets in the Jewish people, double the number of Israelites who left Egypt. So at least 1.2 million people. We have a lot of prophets. So why do we only know about 50? Maybe? Ela Nevuashi Hutzrecha Ledorot Nichteva, Veshelo Hutzrechu Lo Nichteva. Prophecy which was needed for history is recorded. Prophecy which the history doesn't need to know isn't recorded. Rashi pushes it a bit farther in Chulin, and he says, Torah Moshe Kruya Torah, Lefisha Nitna Torah Ledorot. Torah, anything in Chumash, is timeless. Shel Nevi'im Lo Kari Ela Kabbalah. But things in the prophets are only called Kabbalah, called tradition, not Torah. Shekiblu miruach hakodesh kol nevuah unevuah v'vitzorech hasha'ah v'ador v'hamaaseh. Because those prophecies were only given for that generation, what they needed at that time. The books of Nevi'im may be timeless, but the story they tell and the way they're written focuses on one aspect of our religious life. And therefore, Yirmiyahu tells his story and the story of Melachim in one light because he has one story to tell. In the time of the destruction, in this time of rebuilding, those same stories take on a very different light. And therefore, Divrei Hayamim is a historiographical work. It retells history with a different angle. And that's what we're going to try to figure out quickly. I've given you here, I think, 2 examples. We'll see if we get through them. You could take a million, right? You could go through it and you could note that there are certain central events that aren't mentioned in Divrei Hayamim. So, for example, if I had to pick my top 10 list of historical events in Jewish history, definitely up in the top 5 would be Yetziat Mitzrayim. Yetziat Mitzrayim is not mentioned. And it just doesn't get any time in Divrei Hayamim. That's sort of funny when you think about it, right, if you're telling history. But I can't focus on everything, so I've taken a few stories. So let's start with Ahaz. Okay, who's Ahaz? Ahaz is one of the many, many, many wicked kings in Melachim. Melachim is a story of a lot of wicked kings, a few decent kings, and then very few good kings. I can name the good kings on one hand. 2 fingers. Three fingers. David, Chizkiyahu, and Yoshiyahu. That's it. Right? There are other people who are like decently good, like Yoshaphat. But there's only like, what?
Asa was okay.
He's okay. There's a few. There's 3 great kings, David, Chizkiyahu, right, and Yoshiyahu. There's a few decent kings, like what?
Yosef.
There's a few. Shlomo is like, eh. Shlomo at the end, according to the he's good at the beginning. There's some decent ones. There's bad and there's terrible. What?
It's true. David also.
Yeah. But David in the end we like, and Shlomo we don't like in the end. So okay. Or we do like, but you know what I mean. Right? Less like. We're not clear. Chazal, right? I didn't get into it in Melachim, but Chazal had a...
Tanakh really likes both of them, though.
Well, no. Tanakh liked Shlomo until Perek Yud Aleph, and then they really, really don't like Shlomo. And Chazal sometimes like Shlomo, and sometimes say he has no chelek in Olam Haba, and that God had to stop them from saying that. So, Shlomo is a complicated figure. A lot of complicated figures. Only 2 people, post-David, who are really, really good. Okay? What?
Yosef.
No one's really good. Only Yoshiyahu and Chizkiyahu. Anyways, only... Not important. Not important. We can go through this later. Ahaz, though, is bad. Chaz is the father of Chizkiyahu. He's bad. Very bad. Chizkiyahu is great partially because he drags his father's bones around to degrade them. Like, Achaz is bad. Very, very bad. But let's read the story in Melachim and Divrei Hayamim. And let's look for differences and then try to figure out what's going on. Okay, so, number 5. How bad is Achaz? So in Melachim, here's how we get it. Ben Ishrim Shana Achaz B'malcho V'sheish Yisrei Shana Melach Yerushalayim V'lazai Yashar B'nei Adonai Elohav K'David Aviv. Right, so Tanakh clearly likes David. Right, David gets good, right? Achaz is bad. Why is he bad? Because he doesn't do things as well as David. Now if I asked you, how bad is Achaz? I mean, he's bad, but not so bad. Meaning, if I say about someone, he's terrible. He is not, take your pick, Shlomo Zalman Orbach. You're like, well, okay. I don't know if that tells me anything, right? Fine. He's really bad, he's not David. Well, okay, but David is David. He follows the ways of the Israelite king, so that's pretty bad. They're not great. And he passes his child through fire, so that's Molech. That's bad, but it's not clear. Does he kill his son? Not kill his son? Not clear. Right? He passes him through fire. That's a bit ambiguous. And he brings sacrifices on Bamot and under every tree. Are those idolatrous? Well, not totally clear. Bamot are often, especially in Melachim, non-authorized mizbechot for God. So Achaz is bad, but it's ambiguous. He's bad, but only compared to David. He passes his son through fire. That's bad, but we don't know if he kills him. We're not quite sure what he does. And he brings Karbanot to the Bamot, which could be avodah zarah, could be not. It's sort of ambiguous. We don't know. 6. One of the challenges Achaz faces is the Syro-Ephraimite War. So what is that? So if you look, Az Yale Ritzin Melech Aram Upekach Re Ben Rimaliyahu Melech Yisrael Yushalayim La Milchama Vayatsiru Al Achaz Vayachulu Lehilachem. So King Rezin of Aram, Pekach son of Rimaliyahu of Yisrael advanced on Yerushalayim for battle. They besiege Achaz, but they cannot overcome him. Continue in the English. At that time, King Rezin of Aram recovered Elad for Aram. He drove out the Judites from Elad, and the Edomites came to Elad and settled there. It's still the case. Achaz sent messengers to King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria to say, I am your servant and your son. Come and deliver me from the hands of the king of Aram and from the hands of the king of Israel who are attacking me. Achaz took the gold and silver that were on hand in the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the royal palace and sent them as a gift to the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria responded to his request. The king of Assyria marched against Damascus and captured it. He deported its inhabitants to Kir and put Rezin to death. So, he faces a war. He's losing. He takes the gold from the Mikdash, uses it to bribe Tiglath-Pileser, who then comes and conquers his enemy and he wins. So, how good and how bad does Achaz come out of this story? So, does he lose the battle?
No.
No, right? He's losing and then he manages to win. So, politically, he comes out okay. Religiously, is stripping the Beit HaMikdash of its gold good, bad, terrible, mediocre, what is it?
Terrible.
So you would think terrible, but it's not. Because his son, Chizkiyahu, who's a superhero, does the same thing, and we love Chizkiyahu. We absolutely love Chizkiyahu. Melachim loves Chizkiyahu, and Divrei Yamim obsesses over Chizkiyahu. They love him. And Yeshayahu also likes Chizkiyahu. Everyone likes Chizkiyahu. So it's not clear. He's, again, ambiguous. Politically, you know, he manages to salvage it. And religiously, he takes the gold from the Beit HaMikdash, which sounds really bad, but the truth is, it's just de rigueur.
But he also can replace it, no?
No, he doesn't replace it. Chizkiyahu also doesn't replace it. What? No, he doesn't replace it because he doesn't have the money to. Where is he going to get the money?
Like in 5 years.
You would think, but that's not what happens. And he's not the only one. His son, like I said, his son does, and his son is great. 7. There's an altar, okay? Look at the English. When King Ahaz went to Damascus to greet King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria, he saw the altar in Damascus. King Ahaz sent the priest Uriah a sketch of the altar and detailed plan of its construction. The priest Uriah did just as King Ahaz had instructed him from Damascus. The priest Uriah built the altar before King Ahaz returned from Damascus. So he goes to Damascus, he sees the altar, and he mimics the altar of Damascus in Yerushalayim. You skip to 14, he also moves the altar of God, the Mizbeach of God. So I ask you, is that a good thing, bad thing, or somewhere in the middle? So you would think bad. There's a problem with thinking it's terrible, though, which is, who was his messenger to do this? Uriah. Is Uriah good, mediocre, or bad? He's great. We love him. How do I know? Look at 8. Yeshayahu says, "Va'ida li'edim ne'manim et Uriah kohen v'tzachariyahu ben Yiverchiyahu." Yeshayahu calls him. He singles him out as one of his reliable witnesses. He is a great person. So, one more in 9. Ahaz cuts off the inserts from the Mikdash and he gives it to the king of Assyria. Okay, again, we've said that sort of in between, we don't know how to take that. So in Malachim, Ahaz is bad, but how bad is he? It's not clear. Politically, he salvages it. He's bringing Kurbanot, which may or may not be of idolatrous. He builds an altar, which may or may not be idolatrous, but it has the seal of approval from Uriah, who Yeshayahu really likes. So Ahaz in Malachim is bad, but how bad is he? You know, he's bad. He's not like terrible, he's bad. Look at this, the same story in Divrei Hayamim. 10. Number 10. Okay. So remember before, he passed his son through fire. We don't know if he killed him. We don't know exactly what he did. Look at Pasuk Gimel, the first one. He made offerings in the valley of Ben Hinnom and burned his sons in fire in the abhorrent fashion of the nations which the Lord has dispossessed before the Israelites. So, good, neutral, absolutely atrocious. Atrocious. Right, atrocious. That's going to be the answer to every question now, okay? Right? Just hint, right? Great. Now, he brings on the Bamot. So, he sacrificed and made offerings on the shrines, on the hills, and under every leafy tree. The Lord has delivered him over the king of Aram, who defeated him and took many of his men captive, and it brought him to Damascus. He was also delivered over to the king of Israel and inflicted a great defeat on him. He sacrifices on the Bamot, and immediately what happens? He's punished. In Malachim, remember, politically he emerges sort of okay. How does he emerge politically here? Bad. Very bad. He gets destroyed. At that time, King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria for help. Again, the Edomites came and inflicted a defeat on Judah and took captives. Thus, the Lord brought Judah low on account of King Ahaz of Israel, for he threw off restraint in Judah and trespassed against the Lord. Is he criticized this time for bringing in Tiglath-Pileser? Pileser, he's very angry at him, right? Very angry. And God tells you that he destroys him for trespassing against God. And in 23, he tells you unequivocally that on that altar, which was questionable, he's bringing sacrifices to the gods of Damascus who defeated him. So, politically, he comes out terrible. All his crimes are exacerbated. So, in Malachim, politically, he sort of survives. Religiously, he's like, you know, unclear. In Divrei Hayamim, he is terrible, and politically, he suffers miserably. Chizkiyo is the opposite phenomenon. Chizkiyo, as I said, in Malachim, is a hero. Divrei Hayamim is a superhero. So, Chizkiyo, number 11, okay? Here, let's skip to the English. So, in the third year of King Hoshea, son of Elah of Israel, Chizkiyo, son of King Ahaz of Judah, became king. He did what was pleasing to the Lord, just as his father David had done. He abolished the shrine, smashed the pillars, cut down the sacred post. He broke into pieces the bronze serpent that Moshe had made, for until that time the Israelites had been offering sacrifices to it. It was called Nehushtan. He trusted only in the Lord the God of Israel. There was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those before him. He clung to the Lord. He did not turn away from it, from following him. He kept the commandments that the Lord had given Moses. And the Lord was always with him. He was successful wherever he turned. He rebelled against the king of Assyria, would not serve him, etc. So, Chizkiyahu, good guy. Agreement? He's a good guy. Right? Okay, fine. But then what happens? In the 14th year of King Chizkiyahu, King Sennacherib of Assyria marched against all the fortified towns of Judah and seized them. King Chizkiyahu sent his message to the king of Assyria at Lachish, I have done wrong, withdraw from me, and I shall bear whatever you impose on me. So the king of Assyria imposed upon King Chizkiyahu of Judah a payment of 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Politically, how successful is Chizkiyahu? Right? It's not great. He has to pay tribute to Assyria. And he has to cut off, in 15 and 16, he has to cut off the silver and gold in the Mikdash, which his father had done. And still, Assyria comes, and they still fight against him. And in 19, Rav Shakeh, who's the officer of the king of Assyria, tells him that, well, why are you so confident? The king of Assyria is going to defeat you. Do you think you're relying on Paro? You're not going to win. In the end of the day, a miracle does happen, and all of Sennacherib's army dies at the doors. So Chizkiyahu is a good guy, but he has some troubles politically. He ends up being saved in the end, and he commits, not a crime, but he does the same thing that his father did, that same ambiguous action of cutting off the gold of the Mikdash. And later on, in 12, Chizkiyahu makes a mistake. After defeating Sennacherib, messengers come from this far-off city called Bavel, and they come and say, hey, we heard that there was this miracle with Sennacherib, and then we heard that you were sick and you miraculously were healed. Can you tell us more about it? And he says, hey, come, let me show you my gold and silver. And Yeshayahu says, though that was the wrong thing to do, and because you did that, in the future, Bavel is going to come, they're going to destroy the Beit, you know, they're going to take the Beit HaMikdash, all your treasure is going to be taken away to Bavel. So Chizkiyahu is really, really good, politically has a bit of a difficult time, makes some mistakes, and gets some punishments. So he's good. Divrei Hayamim, he is literally the greatest hero who has ever lived. Right, Georgina will argue, maybe it's Yoshiyahu. But okay, it's either Yoshiyahu or Chizkiyahu. But they're both really, really great. There are many chapters devoted to the fact that Chizkiyahu, I'll tell you why I think this is great, why he's the best. Look at Pasuk Chav Vav, this is number 14. He rebuilds all of Eretz Yisrael. He rebuilds the Beit HaMikdash. He gets everybody to worship in the Beit HaMikdash. He does unbelievable things. Not only does he get all of Yehudah to come to Beit HaMikdash, he does something that hasn't been done since Shlomo HaMelech, and he brings people from Malchut Yisrael, right, meaning not the Judean kingdom, from the Israelite kingdom, also brings them back to the Beit HaMikdash and brings a Korban Pesach. And the Pasuk tells you, Pasuk Chavav, there was great rejoicing in Jerusalem, for since the time of King Solomon, son of David of Israel, nothing like it had happened in Jerusalem. Okay? Dirayam tells you, he is the greatest person since before the Piluga Melucha, before the kingdoms were split. He is awesome. Okay? And Sennacherib, when he fights against him, look at chapter 32. Remember in Malachim, he has this back and forth, and the king of Assyria conquers some towns, and only then he pays him tribute, and then eventually he has a miracle happen to him, but he's already suffered a setback. If you look at Divrei Hayamim, in chapter 32, this is still in 14, after these faithful deeds, King Sennacherib of Assyria invaded Judah, encamped against his fortified towns with the aim of taking them over. What does that sound like? With the aim of taking them over. What does that imply? He didn't. Right? It sounds like he came to battle, but he never succeeded. So, Chizkiyahu is described as the greatest person ever, and as opposed to in Malachim, where we hear that first he had military setbacks before he had the miraculous save, he was miraculously saved from the king of Assyria. Here, the king of Assyria only attempts to fight against him. So, Ahaz in Malachim is like sort of bad, and politically is sort of makes it out, you know, he ekes by. Chizkiyahu is pretty good, makes some mistakes, has some political setbacks, overall is successful. In Divrei Hayomim, Ahaz is evil and fails in everything. Chizkiyahu is the best person ever, and nothing bad happens to him ever. How are these the same stories? And the answer, as I started with, is that they're the same stories. But Divrei Hayomim and Malachim are telling two different tales. So, if you skip to 17, Rabbi Chaim Angel summarizes it. And he said, these are the things that change between the books, and here's why. One, reward and punishment in Kings and Chronicles. Like many other biblical books, Kings leaves many events, good and bad, unexplained theologically. In contrast, Chronicles links virtually everything political and personal to direct reward and punishment. Additionally, Kings teaches that the political and religious actions of one generation, both good and bad, can affect later generations. In contrast, Chronicles adopts the view of Yechezkel 18 and almost completely eliminates intergenerational merit and retribution from its historical narrative. The person who sins, only he shall die. Within the theological framework of Kings, then, Ahaz could be wicked, yet suffer few repercussions during his lifetime. Chizkiyahu could be righteous, yet inherit the consequence of Ahaz's politics and endure the near destruction of Judea. In contrast, within the theological framework of Chronicles, Ahaz was wicked, so Chronicles reports great losses in his lifetime. First difference, Malachim is happy to say that sometimes bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. So, Ahaz made mistakes, but politically he makes it out not so bad. Chizkiyahu is great, but you know what? He's Ahaz's son and he inherits Ahaz's problems. In Divrei Hayamim, it's not true. If Chizkiyahu is good, then everything is good. If Ahaz is bad, everything is bad. Alliances in Malachim and Chronicles. In Malachim, alliances are neutral. And therefore, the fact that he makes an alliance actually works out well for him. In Divrei Hayamim, we ignore the benefits of alliances, and we talk about how terrible they can be. Why is this true? And this is the fundamental question. It's very nice to say that they present different views, which at some level are both true. Right? Sometimes good things happen to good people. I talked about this with Kohelet versus Mishlei. Sometimes good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And sometimes bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people. God. Why does Divrei Hayamim present the perfect perspective, and why does Malachim present the complicated perspective? So, here seems to be the difference. A longer view of history. Malachim is writing in the destruction of the temple. And therefore, all the consequences of the bad political mistakes, or just the bad politics, or the bad everything, all the sins, they're still feeling it. You can't tell the people then that history isn't complicated. They know it is. They've lived through it. They're still suffering the consequences of the bad kings, even though there have been good kings in the middle. The goal of Malachim, it ends with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. You need to describe to them how they got to where they are, the whole complex narrative. By the time you get to Divrei Hayamim, they're back, they're rebuilding. All of that is ancient history. From their perspective, things are, right, that's the past, things are basically good now. It doesn't matter as much, all the vicissitudes of history. What does matter? What matters, as Reitzer Chiner pointed out in Ezra Nehemiah, is that we need to cheer the people on. We need to encourage them and say, you're doing the right thing going back. So as I said with Mishlei versus Kohelet, when you're cheering people on, you're teaching your little kids, like in Mishlei, what do? You simplify history. Good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. We're going back to Eretz Yisrael. We're rebuilding. Forget what's happened in the past. The message you need to pull out of history is that good people get good things. Bad people get bad things. So do the right thing. Because times are good, do the right thing. I'm encouraging you. All that political stuff doesn't really matter anymore because we're past it. That era is gone. We're in the era of the second Beit HaMikdash. It has a longer view of history. And the longer view of history, what matters is the lessons you pull from them. And you can sort of afford to gloss over some of the details to make a point. Melachim is explaining to the people in the time of the destruction how they got where they are. And that history is a complicated one. So Divrei Hayamim is, as I said, deja vu, but not quite. It retells the story that the people who are coming back to Yerushalayim need to hear. They need to hear the simplified view of history from Adam HaRishon all the way to their time. The story of how good things happen to good people. And if you just do the right thing, it'll all work out. And vice versa, to encourage them to themselves follow the way back. And also it minimizes the tragedy. Because don't dwell on all the problems we've had. Because they're not important anymore. Good times have come. Let's not talk about it as much. It's a book written to give people courage. So it's deja vu, but not quite. And with that, we finish Tanakh, sort of.